So, Daniel, he is, as we said a moment ago, an example of a believer living in an unbelieving world. One lovely thing about the book of Daniel, actually, which I hope to look at while we go through, is that it gives us an example of a believer in an unbelieving world at every major stage in life, child, adult, old man. It shows this, his whole life is shown, in episodes in each part of his life. The whole life of a believer in an unbelieving world. Somebody living in the world, but not of the world. Daniel has been taken far from his home in Israel and brought to this pagan empire, the capital city of the richest superpower in the world at that time. The book of Daniel, it seems to have been written for believers in the pagan world. Daniel and his friends, they were taken to Babylon in 597 BC. And 10 years later, almost the entire nation was brought to Babylon. So he was the first. Just a select group were taken. But later, Nebuchadnezzar went back and trashed Jerusalem and took everyone to Babylon as slaves. And the book eventually, it functioned as a handbook for believers living in an unbelieving world. In a pagan land. Many didn't go back for centuries, but just lived scattered throughout the nations. And Daniel's book became a huge encouragement. It gave them a model to follow. It showed God is in control. They really needed to hear that. God is in control. So it's very much a manual for believers. Still is. We're reading it now. It's also, though, a witness for unbelievers. It's a fascinating book. It reads like an evangelistic tract. It was written in two languages. Most of it's in Hebrew, the language of the Old Testament. But the central heart of the book is written in Aramaic, the language of Babylon. And it is addressed directly to them and is written, in fact, by the most sensational convert in Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar himself. And it's written to persuade others, to call others to faith in the living God. So the book was intended as well, probably, to be read by their captors as well as by them. And that in itself gives us a clue for how do we live in an unbelieving world. We love them. We're concerned for them. We pray for them. We seek their good. And what is their best good that we can pray for is that they come to know the Lord too. So today in chapter 1, and we're going to look at this again next week, we meet the young Daniel and his three friends as they are taken forcibly from their homeland and brought to Babylon, the great empire of the day. That was terrifying, surely. What a terrifying experience, no doubt. But also, that was incredibly exciting. Must have been. These young men are being brought into a world of excitement. How are they going to survive? How are they going to walk with the Lord in this situation? There is stuff here for everyone, but I think it's particularly helpful for you younger people in the room, children and teenagers and young adults, as you are going into the world, gradually becoming more and more independent and coming out into the world. How are you going to survive? I want to see three things this morning. And the first is you do need to understand the world you live in. Understand it. To be in the world but not of it, you need to know the world around you and recognize how you are in it but not of it. You need to recognize how the world around you thinks, what it values, what it believes. So this is relevant to everyone, but especially as you are moving out into the world in your youth. You go up through the school years. Some of you are in primary school, some of you are in secondary school. You progress, and you learn and grow. Then comes that awesome, glorious, and wonderful day when someone gives you a smartphone for the first time, and a whole world opens up to you. And then you just move on. Eventually, you get a job, you go to work, or maybe you go and study, you go to university. And you're moving into a more adult social world, and it's all new to you. The people often, when they're young, try to act as though they know all this. But deep down, they're thinking, am I getting away with it? Are they buying my bluff? Because you don't know. You just don't know. You're growing up. You're encountering a new world. And it is. You're getting more and more independence. It's vital. And it is exciting. It is exciting. And you need to get... It's vital to have a right understanding of the world that you are moving into and that you inhabit. Here's three things that about the world, for starters, from Daniel. One, this whole new world is opening up to Daniel and his friends. It is extremely attractive. Start there. It is attractive. Think, they've been taken from Jerusalem, the capital city of a country that has been in decline for centuries, and in the last few months has been under siege. The place then was an impoverished tip, and they've been brought out of that to Babylon. With its incredible wealth, incredible power, it is stunning architecture. That was the place of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was the great center of learning. It had the masters of science and technology. It was the cutting edge of technology where they were going. The whole thing was stunning. It was amazing. Ascendant Babylon looks so superior to declining Israel. It's like moving from a village into the big city. It's like moving from school, and all you've known for 7 years is the secondary school, you know, all the classrooms, and suddenly you're in university with this beautiful campus and all these things, exciting things going on. And this is what they're being brought to. It's like going from Northampton suburbs to New York to London to Paris. A new life opens up. And there's something in them that though this is frightening, they must have also been thinking, wow, and is this not the best thing that has ever happened to us? This is so, it's attractive, incredibly attractive. And we have to be honest, the world in which we live is an extremely attractive world. Why? God made it. It's a world made by God. And he made it good. And he has filled it with wonderful things. And as you grow up, you're going out into a wonderful world. It's so much excitement, so much that's good and wonderful. And God made man in his image. So man is filling the world with beautiful things, wonderful things, ingenious things, designs and inventions. And this is the world that we are called to be in, but not of. And it is a wonderful place. And the people, too, in so many ways, are wonderful. You're going to meet exciting, fun, inspiring, entertaining people, people worthy of great respect, interesting people, kind people. You're going to meet so many people. And you've got to recognize that and don't feel guilty about it. There is so much to admire in the world. Good things, great things. It's an attractive world. But you have to remember, it is more than attractive. This is a second word for you. It's seductive. Look at Daniel's experience. The King Nebuchadnezzar, ruler of Babylon, he had a clear intention when he deported these exiles, these elites. Do you remember that first time he went and Daniel was brought out with the cream? This was his policy. Whenever Nebuchadnezzar conquered another nation, his policy was take the cream of the nation and turn them into Babylonians. That was his policy. And so these Jews, he is going to destroy their cultural distinctiveness and assimilate them into Babylonian culture. And this was how he subdued a nation. Turn them into Babylonians. And so Daniel and his friends, they're the top of society. We're told in the beginning, who was selected? Verse 3 and 4. Bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding learning, competent to stand in the king's place. Daniel was amongst that lot. Daniel and his friends, you are the best of the best of the best. You are the movers and shakers in your society. You're going to be the leaders of your society. I want you, and I'm going to turn you into Babylonians. The aim was to destroy the Israelites' distinct identity as a people set apart. And this program involved three things. First, they were given new names, Babylonian names, that And those names are all to do with pagan gods. Daniel means God is my judge. His name is changed to Belshazzar. Belshazzar means Bel is my God. Bel was one of the Babylonian deities. All their names are linked with Babylonian deities. So they got a new name, then they're put on a three-year course of study, a complete education in Babylonian culture. They do a liberal arts degree in the leading pagan university. What an opportunity. It's exciting. But what is it? Is Babylonian magic, enchanting, all this stuff? Well, that's part two. And at the end of those 3 years, they'd be qualified to be in the civil service of Babylon. A good job. And can you see what was going on? And the third thing was they were going to become accustomed to the lavish lifestyle of the Babylonians. They were going to eat from the king's table. This is what the king Nebuchadnezzar eats. You're going to eat his food, you're going to drink his wine. Can you see what the aim was? The aim was Nebuchadnezzar wanted them in Babylon and of Babylon. And that is still how the world works. The Bible is very clear. Culture isn't neutral. Behind the scenes, there are spiritual powers and forces at work that want you to conform. You're in the world, and Satan wants you to be of the world. And he is working at that. Now, it's no surprise when you get to the book of Revelation, and it's all images and pictures and visions to teach us things. And there you see the unbelieving world is represented in one of the visions as a city called Babylon, and it's pictured as a temptress. You have to recognize that an attempt is being made to assimilate the Christian. So you're not just in the world, but you are, in fact, of the world. Now, it's not like, this is one for Star Trek fans, it's not like the Borg. And if you this switch off for the next 2 minutes, Star Trek means nothing to you. The Borg are these aliens who travel across the universe in these vast spaceships in the shape of a big cube. And they arrive at your planet and they boom out, "We are the Borg. Resistance is futile. Prepare to be assimilated." And they literally turn you into them by plugging something into your neck and so on. Not subtle. The world is far more subtle. It doesn't announce itself. The world is seductive. It draws you in, and you have to realize that. In Romans 12, verse 2, we looked at these verses last year, we're told, "Do not be conformed to this world." It doesn't say do not conform to, but do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. He's saying, if you are not being molded by God, then something else is molding you. Do not be conformed. The world wants to conform you to its pattern. One translation puts it, it wants to squeeze you into its mold. And it wants your thinking molded completely in a completely different way to Christ's way. And that molding process will happen quite naturally if you are not actively seeking to grow in Christ. Here's a quote from theologian Tahiti Anyabwili. I'm not sure how you say it, African theologian. "I think there is a tendency to underestimate the lethal potency and sophisticated subtlety of the world. The world is not a safe place. The world is not like colourful soft Play-Doh. We can't just mould it and shape it in whatever fun colours we like. The world enslaves. It shapes back." So it's a very striking image. You're enjoying the things of the world. You're picking and choosing what you like. You're imagining you're in control, that you're shaping the world, your world and your environment like a kid just shaping a lump of Play-Doh, when in fact, it is shaping you. That's happening. And you have to be extremely alert to this. Another theologian, Van Til, "A Christian unaware of the problem of leading a Christian life in a non-Christian society is progressively being de-Christianized by all sorts of unconscious pressures that operate upon him through the media of culture." It's happening. The world is attractive and it is seductive. And the third thing to say, third word, it is also unavoidable. You have to understand that. Daniel and his friends had no choice. They couldn't just go home. And so with us, here we are. We are here. The issue is not whether or not we should be involved in this world. We just are. We are in the world. The issue is, will we be of the world? Where do we draw the line? I've got a picture here. I thought this was funny. This is a Pepsi advert from the past. I don't know how much you can see that. In the 1940s, that's how you advertise Pepsi. That advert, if you read the small print, says, look how big the bottle is, and it tastes really nice. Buy Pepsi. Get loads of it. Tastes really nice. Here's today's advert. Bang. Doesn't tell you anything about what's in that can, but look at the people who drink it. Aren't they cool? It's selling you the Pepsi lifestyle. I think one of the adverts has David Beckham drinking Pepsi, and it says, live without regrets. That's the Pepsi drinker. Here's the question. Can you drink Pepsi Cola without buying into the Pepsi lifestyle? Are you allowed to? How much of the world can you enjoy without buying into its ways, conforming to its mold? See, our third heading then, we said we've got to understand the world. And the second one, evaluate the world you live in. You're constantly evaluating, thinking. What can I accept? What do I reject? Some things we have to accept. We've already said Daniel can't go home. But now he's got these three things we mentioned. What is that Nebuchadnezzar's way of conforming and molding and shaping them into? What is he going to do with them? He's got a new name. Now, does he think to himself, well, God, Bel is not my God. I'm not going to answer to the name Belteshazzar. Belshazzar. I'm Daniel. Sorry, I'm Daniel. If you could do, is he going to go around just ignoring people until they use his name? He doesn't do that. What about the studies? They're going to teach him magic. And he's going to study all the so-called wisdom of Babylon. All the learning. And some of it, no doubt, will be wonderful. And some of it will be absolute nonsense. Is he going to say, I'm not reading that. You've got to be joking. He obviously didn't. He gets a first-class degree. He's the best. He must have thrown himself. He did his homework. Threw himself into his studies. Say, I'll learn your garbage. He learns it all. What about the third thing? Now, here's this thing, you see. He chooses to reject one of the privileges which went with his position. Verse 8, he says, I'm not going to eat your food. You say, he doesn't say it like that, does he? But he's polite, and he says, I'm going to take your new name. I'm going to be educated in unbelieving pagan culture. But I'm not going to eat the food, the royal food and the wine. Why does he draw the line at that point? Now, the commentators are divided on this, as you can imagine. And I think there are two things that some put forward, which I don't think are right at all. First, some say Daniel didn't eat the food because it failed to conform to the Jewish dietary laws. Some people say, no, it's not. They don't eat the food because it's not kosher. But that's not correct, because he doesn't only refuse the food. He says, I'm just going to eat vegetables. He also refuses the wine. And there's nothing wrong with drinking wine. That was not forbidden in any of the Old Testament. So the dietary laws, and also the dietary laws of Moses, were not vegetarian. So I don't think it's like at all. As some have said, the reason Daniel doesn't eat the food is because he knows it's probably been offered to idols beforehand. It's been part of the idolatrous worship of and their ceremonies. Now, that is likely to have been the case, that had happened. But the author doesn't say that. And I think it's unlikely that is the lesson we're meant to learn. I think the lesson is more subtle than that. What is going on here? He is seeking to guard his heart. This is the first thing. Guard your heart. It's very striking. There's no laws being broken here. He is not breaking. There's nothing intrinsically unlawful about Daniel eating this food. He didn't reject the food because it broke a law. It took a lot more thought and reflection than that. He was evaluating his world. He was drawing a line drawn by wisdom, not absolute morality, rules. Daniel doesn't decide, and I'm going to keep a rule here, but I'm going to keep control of my life. That's what's happening here. In some way that only Daniel and his friends would know, the king's food was a temptation and to move beyond just learning about Babylon, but adopting Babylon, the priorities and the values of Babylon. That was one step further than he was prepared to go to accommodate to this pagan world. He was staying in control. Notice it says, I don't want to defile myself with this food. And he uses a religious word. It means spiritual pollution. How did Daniel feel this was going to pollute him? If he's not breaking any rules, well, we can't be sure. But I think there's three very possible reasons. One, the king's food is part of this rich, luxury-loving lifestyle that was part of the ideal for that idolatrous society. This is the ideal. This is what it's all about. Idol worship was basically a way of seeking power from the gods so you can be secure and you can be prosperous. It's a selfish life. You're not really worshipping the idols. You're worshipping what you can get out of the idols because you want this. Biblical worship, what Daniel is doing, he's worshipping the true and living God. And it means humbling yourself. And you receive grace so that you can serve others. Couldn't be more different, could it? Daniel did not want to be warped and have his desires pressed into that pagan mold. It's essentially, you can imagine all that food comes out and they start, wow, I could get used to this. Ooh. And then he thinks, I don't want to get used to this. This is going to change my heart. This is going to tempt me into that whole idolatrous love of money and status and beauty and material luxury and power. That was the essence of that pagan worldview. This is the entry-level drug, if you like. He didn't want to lose his heart to that view of life because so easily happened. You could continue to worship God on the outside, but your heart has been drawn away. Guard your heart. That gives us so much guidance for us now, living in an unbelieving world. Daniel wants to. He shows us we can't simply rely on keeping the rules. Didn't do anything wrong. Didn't break any rules. All right. Now he knew that in some way eating the food was going to pull his heart away from complete commitment to the Lord. We've got to be so careful in the same way. Guard your heart. It's possible to keep all the rules, but your heart is being drawn away to the real idols of our culture. You need to recognize what are the idols of our culture. Traditional cultures, the idols of family and family connections and duty and custom and things like that. In more secular cultures, there's the idols of personal fulfillment and status and beauty and power. And these are idols. They're intellectual idols. People idolize study and learning. It's a temptation for you at university. Make an idol of these studies and these achievements. And these aren't formal idols, are we? There isn't a religious statue representing these things. But they are what people give our hearts to, the idols of the heart. And they can be smuggled into your life, even when you're formally believing all the right stuff. And Friday, we talked about the Beatitudes. So in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus begins with this list of things. He says, this is the blessed life. Blessed are the something, for they will something. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, because they will be filled. And we try to think of, okay, what's the Beatitudes of the world in which we live? So here is some. We went for blessed are the rich, for they can have whatever they want. Blessed are the successful, for they will be admired. Blessed are the beautiful, for they will be adored. Blessed are the funny, for they will have friends. Blessed are the clever, for they will get good jobs. And we did a few of them. You can go on and on. I think that is the last one. But you see that the world's beatitudes are so different from Christ's beatitudes. And you look at those things. Which of those will pull away my heart? And those things, none of them are sinful. There's no rule against them, and they are in themselves very good things. But you have to evaluate the world and ask. The idols are not sinful things necessarily, but are things that are just ordinary things, even good things, that have become ultimate things. This is it. This is what I live for. I give my heart to this. Which idols ring your bells? You've got to guard your heart. You've got to be very careful. Evaluate the world. Recognize its idols. Recognize the idols of your heart. abstain. It may be necessary for you to abstain for something that isn't bad at all. But you know your heart. You've got to guard it. I love this little story. There's a billionaire who is hiring a new chauffeur to drive him around in his limousine. And he took them to an edge of a cliff. And he said, which of you three, I want to ask each of you, who can drive me closest to the edge of this cliff? And one guy looked and said, I could drive you to within 3 feet. And the next one said, I could drive you to 1 foot of the edge. And the third one said, I don't know, and I'm not going to find out. Who deserves the job? But this is it. We don't live close to the edge. We guard our hearts. And notice, by keeping the commitment of the Lord, rather than falling to this commitment to idols, these young men actually came to see through it all. They saw through the wisdom of Babylon. They mastered it. They became masters of that worldly wisdom rather than be mastered by it. And as a result, actually, they were far more useful to the king. They understood it thoroughly, but they saw its weaknesses. That's a great model for us. Don't separate from the pagan culture and withdraw into a Christian ghetto, which has always been a temptation to Christians. But instead, understand the world you're in. It's learning, and what's good about it, what's bad about it, and assess it wisely, evaluate, so you can expose what is false. What are the bankrupt commitments that are at the bottom of all these unbelieving societies? Then we too can be masters of wisdom. And two, it's all a lot quicker after this. An additional reason, I think, that he evaluates the world. What made him make his choices? Why didn't he eat the food? I think a second thing to say, he and his friends wanted to bear witness to the Babylonians. He wants to be a witness to the world around him. They wanted these Babylonians to know that they were going to keep their distinctive identity. I'm a Jew. I'm a God-fearing man. I worship the living God. I want you to know that. In verse 9, it says, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. Is it God has already begun to work in the heart of this chief official through the witness of Daniel? He warms to these guys. And then we get this very interesting test in verse 11 onwards, where one commentator calls this a wisdom test. Daniel is saying, okay, let's compare wisdoms. The king is afraid, the king's official is afraid that Daniel's idea, simple lifestyle, will make him pale and weak. It's not wise, Daniel. And Daniel is saying, this is the Lord's wisdom. Let's test these wisdoms out. 10-day trial. They're comparing wisdoms. This is not the Bible teaching us that vegetarianism is superior to eating meat. I had to say that because of my way I feel about vegetables. But it is very interesting, isn't it? They're saying, okay, this worship idols to get power and security and wealth and going. That's one worldview. This is the wisdom of the Lord. I'm trusting in the Lord will keep us strong and healthy. And he's bearing testimony to the Lord's wisdom. And in the end, they are healthier than those who ate the king's food. The Lord vindicates his faithfulness. And they're wiser than the other people on their course. It's interesting, isn't it? You students, is the Lord's wisdom being demonstrated in your life? Are you wiser than the other people on your course? Because your lifestyle, the way you use your money, you're not, you know, up all night and sleeping all day. You're careful. You're not getting drunk. You're modest. You're chaste. All these things. The Lord's wisdom is wiser than the wisdom of the world. And people learn that by seeing it acted out before them, lived out before them. Jeremiah wrote a letter to the exiles, and Daniel read this letter and refers to it in the book. And he said, this is what the Lord wants you exiles to do. Seek the peace and blessing of the society you're in. Pray for this city. Seek its shalom. Talk more about this next Sunday. But they were to get involved in the life and society of their culture, keep their conscience clean, be the distinctive people of God, be undefiled, and show their distinctive life of God as a witness to the people around them. So that's so important, isn't it? Okay, they need to see the fruit of God's wisdom in their lives. Let's jump to the third one. This is such a good witness. You do have to look at your life and say, is it remarkable or is it not? Is your character and wisdom different from that around you? Do you just parrot the world's wisdom and live it out? Or do you live by the truth and wisdom from above? You must do that. And we have to tell an unbeliever why we're different. The New Testament urges us, live a godly life and be ready to say why. Why are you living that way? And if you are living a godly life, people will eventually say, what are you doing? Why don't you do what we're all doing? Why don't you come out with us tonight? Why don't you say this? Why do you withdraw when we're talking about that? Why? Because we want them to know the Lord. The third reason, the third probable reason Daniel abstains from the food. I'll just throw this one in. It is encouraging other believers. We evaluate the world we live in and we think, I'm going to live for the Lord, because I want to guard my own heart, I want to be a witness to the world around me, and I want to encourage my fellow believers. There's nothing more discouraging than to your faith than you see another believer compromise. So hard. Everyone's shoulders sag. And there's nothing more encouraging to your faith to see when you see a fellow believer stand for the Lord. That thrills your heart. I told the Renewed about this on Friday when I was a young teen, year 9 this was. I remember this is a very vivid memory in an English lesson, and we all had to read a page of a book. We were reading round a book, and we had to read a page and so on. And I knew the book was just full of bad language, and I was a young Christian lad, and I didn't want to use bad language, but I was just so embarrassed and nervous of saying anything. And I kind of psyched myself up, and I got in my head, forget it, I'm going to say it. I'm just going to say it. And then this other kid read before me, who I vaguely knew. I knew his name, and I knew that he went to church. I didn't know anything about him, really. He had a page of bad language, and he wouldn't read it. He missed it out. And the teacher stopped him and said, what is this? Read it properly. And he read it again, and he missed it out. And he said, have you got an edited version of the book? Read the words. And suddenly he said, I'm sorry, sir, I'd rather not say it. And the teacher really made it hard. He said, what did you say? He said, I'm sorry, sir, I'd rather not say it. He said, fine. And he let him read it. And this poor guy, from then on, people would always say to him, I'm sorry, sir, I can't say it. They tease him. They remember the line and use it and so on. But I was just, wow. That he just took a stand for the Lord. And I still think of it to this day. I did actually meet him after university and got to know him a little bit. And I brought up I so remember that. And he said, you know what I did after that? I went to the loos and cried my eyes out. That was horrible. But he did it. And it put a certain amount of fire in my belly. I never had to do it. God was merciful to me in that sense. But he did it. Courage is infectious. Daniel's stand was a massive encouragement to the other believers. Still encourages us today. 2,500 years later, we're still reading about Daniel. Stand firm for the sake of the unbelievers who are watching you and for the sake of the believers who are watching you too. Last point, pretty quickly. We said we need to understand the world we live in. We need to evaluate the world we live in. And we need to finally resize the world you live in. I couldn't think of a better word. Reduce the world. Relativize the world you live in. What I mean is this. Daniel had an understanding of God that was large enough and exciting enough to make his stand worthwhile. He was living in this attractive, exciting world, but his vision of God was more exciting. It was bigger, it was better, it was more glorious than Babylon. And that was how he was able to stand firm. Now, you younger people, particularly, you need to have an enlarged vision of God. You need to see his glory as you go out into that world that is full of promise and is full of glitz and it's full of possibilities. The devil wants you to make comparisons. False comparisons. He wants you to believe that you have finally discovered real living. You finally found the real thing, especially if you've been brought up in church. You come out and you say, wow, this has all been hidden from me. And here it is. Now I've got the real thing. He will belittle your God, your Savior. One of my most horrid memories is returning from university for my first term. One of my closest friends came back, and we were gathered in an after-church thing, a little bit like Coram Deo, but it wasn't led in quite the same way. But and he said, wow, university, my eyes, it's been, you people haven't a clue how I've met amazing people and done amazing things, and it's been so brilliant. And you just haven't. He was so belittling that everyone just felt beaten down, and no one there was strong enough to say, "Be quiet. Our God is great." But how will you combat that? You see, God vindicates radical faith. He will uphold you. He will show that faith in him is right and better. Daniel does better and better in life because of his faith. Where does the power come from to stand firm like that, to be salt and light, to be a fisher of men, to be a worker in the harvest, to be in the world but not of the world? How will you ever be able to make a radical stand like Daniel did if your vision of God is small? You won't be able to. You need to see that you have a God worth taking a stand for, a God who is worth risking all for, a God who is worth dying for. It comes through, how do you get to know that? It comes through an ever-deepening infatuation with Jesus Christ, with Jesus. Remember, Daniel had two names, Belteshazzar and Daniel. Jesus had two names. He was Son of Man, Son of God. He was Jesus, and he was Emmanuel, God with us. He who is glorious and eternal, the eternal Word, the Son of the living God, he became a man. He became one of us. He became vulnerable. He became hurtable, killable. And he lived and he died on earth, and he did it for a reason. What was the reason? He considered you worth taking a stand for. He considered you worth risking all for, worth dying for. He loved you so much that he didn't just risk his life like Daniel did. He gave his life for you. And one day, he will come back for you. He did this so you could live, so you could one day enjoy the rich food and drink of the king's table. His king, his kingdom, he is the king. The true King of all glory. Now Jesus, he's risen, he's ascended, he's at work in this world, he's building this eternal, indestructible kingdom of God, a kingdom of love and of joy that is the true, glorious, eternal world that is more exciting than anything this present world can offer. Babylon is gone. The world now, this present world is passing away. That put all your time and your energy into that world, into that king. Pray. You've got to work on your vision to grasp the glory of God. Pray like Moses did. Lord, show me your glory. That's the only way you can resist the world's seductive power. You need to have a glorious view of Jesus. I love the image of the sun and the stars. When you're at night time, there's beautiful stars last night, if you notice. Wonderfully clear, glorious night. All these stars shining. Where have they gone? They're not there now. Well, they are still there. Of course they're there. But when the sun rises, their glory is just outshone by the glory of the sun. And so in your life, all these things, they're good things, they're maybe bad things, but just all these things, they shine, they're attractive, they're seductive. You need the glory of the sun to rise. Outshine the glory of the idols of your heart, the idols of our society. So you see, no, there is the true and living God. There is someone, he is the one worth living for and dying for, Jesus. And then the world loses its power to seduce you because you're enamored with the king, the king of glory.